And to open our time of study with prayer. So if you would bow with me. Heavenly Father, we thank you for today. We thank you for the blessing that it is to approach your throne of grace. And it's our hope and our desire that we do so with clarity and with openness to your will. Help us to become a people who are willing to be molded to your service. Help us to be aware of the history and work of you as you have brought the redemption of mankind to its planned outcomes, and that folded into the kingdom as Gentiles, we can see a heaven planned for us. Please forgive us of our sins and watch over our souls. And this is our prayer in your Son's name. Amen. All right, so we're in Joshua. We are actually in middle section of the text. There's a number of things that will happen later in the book of Joshua that are both spiritually important on the big picture narrative storytelling side of God's work with His creation. But now we're kind of in a narrow focus zone where we're talking about some of the interactions of God's people in the land of Canaan and how the spiritual imperatives play out in conjunction with the physical imperatives. Because God has two purposes in part with Israel going in and taking the land. And some of those, unlike we talked about Wednesday night, are deeply challenging on a couple of levels. For reminder's sake, when we talk about those two imperatives, both the spiritual one and the physical one, we're talking about the conflict that exists between Jehovah and His people, and Yahweh and His people, and the pagan practices in Canaan of the various kingdoms and settings that are there, and the gods that they serve. Because it's really important, again, I'll probably make mention of this a lot when we go through now Joshua and Judges, to the participants in the Old Testament, both Israel and the nations around them, the gods that they serve are all real. Whether they be Baal, whether they be the gods of Egypt, and including Jehovah. So their mindset and approach to these relationships is a little bit different than sometimes how we think of things. We think of the gods of the Old Testament as being paper gods, drawn up in the minds of men, and how foolishly it would be for someone to follow a paper god. We are granted additional information that they don't have about a number of things, including the full picture of God's plan. And we talked a lot about the faith involved of the various participants, that they are all, in part, moved by faith. One key component to tie into all of this is even in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, there's biblical sanction for the spiritual realm interacting with the physical realm, demons being the specific point of connection there. So the spiritual imperative that's taking place when God tells Israel to cleanse the land is they're cleansing out the places of worship connected to these gods. And whether you use a little g or a big g doesn't matter. The participants in the Canaanite region, it's a real god that's now being really destroyed by Jehovah. And you see that playing out at times, even in simple things that we look at amazement to, like the sun standing still. That's a spiritual conflict, not necessarily a physical one. The physical one's there too. The physical one is them taking the land, taking the cities, following to various degrees the general command to cleanse the land with levels of specificity that are uncomfortable. That includes things like killing of children, killing of non-military combatants, old folks, mothers, women. That was part of the command. And they follow it to varying degrees. Even at times we see Joshua being the one to take the responsibility both to do the thing, but to be responsible for the thing. And struggle, and we have to struggle through the complicated constructs of, hey, wait a minute, did God just tell them to do this? And then they did that? How do I feel about it? Does it change my understanding of God? And are my feelings betraying me? Feelings are the mixture of emotions that may not necessarily be bound up in fact, because they come as a consequence to what we think to be true, not necessarily what is true. And so there's a lot of that. this section in Joshua allows us to process all of those things. I think it's important for us to be good students through this because this section of the Old Testament is one of the places where in Bible study with non-believers, agnostics or curious folks about the Bible, where they go, hey, wait a minute, didn't God tell His people to do this? Remember we talked about that in our class last year on Sunday, our second Sunday class, and said, hey, what about this? Well, if we're a good student, we have to go back there and say, well, yeah, this is exactly what He told them to do. Or no, that's not what He said. He said this, the people did that, and you're making this conclusion. Because sometimes there's a misunderstanding. Does all that make sense? That's a big kind of quick review of some of the bigger picture things. So that brings us back into the middle of this conquest storytelling point. We've left off also Wednesday night identifying that we're beginning to see a level of incomplete work. You ever been in school and you hand in a project and the teacher gives it back and they say, well, you had great work up to problem number 7, but it's incomplete? That's been me. That's probably been all of us in various degrees. Israel is basically turning in a level of incomplete homework at this point. The text doesn't go into detail in some levels of specificity where it doesn't begin to say now, hey, they didn't take X, Y, and Z. It'll say later that point, but we're seeing the highlights of their successes and the highlights also of their failures. So what? By the way, just to kind of bring us into mindset, up to this point, off the top of your head, from Joshua chapter 1 to Joshua chapter 11, what failures of Israel do we find in the sense of keeping the commands of God regarding their occupation of the land? There's a couple big ones. Gibeonite Treaty, item number 1. Actually, it would be item number 2 on my list, but it's one of our items. Achan. So we have two significant sinful endeavors that represent two types of rebellion. Because they're historically repeats. Has this kind of thing happened for Israel in the past? Or the people of God generally? Well, yeah. Patriarchal levels. There's these kind of weird covenants they make and weird commitments they make. And sometimes some of the patriarchal families steal off with the items of idolatrous worship and take them with them and hide them, even lying about them in their past. And so there's a repeat from a structured telling point. One of the ways that I've suggested we think about the text is an Israelite child sitting on the bank listening to some older person telling them the story of Israel and here's some lessons learned. Well, we've now seen two lesson points where they're not getting the thing completely already. And we're beginning to be aware of the third, which is not completing the task of taking the land. By the way, there's a structure to think about. Did any of the tribes get specific admonition if they failed to help take the land? What was the consequence for them? Right, and so their outcome, if we look at the map side of things, remember if we kind of pull these things up, their outcome was going to be similar to the Moabites, the kings of Moab. They'll be treated like that. Kings of Edom, which is going to be up a little higher in the map space, but also their kind of experiences in that regard. You're going to be treated just like they are. You're going to be just as roughly handled, if you will, as they, if you don't go in and take the land. Did they go in? Did they take the land? Yeah. That's not yet true here, but they went in and participated. So they're not going to be held accountable for their commitments. But here's the parallel I want us to think about in regards to what's happening. Are we familiar with Samson? Everyone knows the story of Samson. Samson's vow. What was Samson's vow referred to as? What kind of vow? Nazirite vow. roughly speaking, what were the things that he had to do in order to keep the vow pure? Cut his hair. Was there anything else? Things that he could eat, things that he could touch, right? So there's actually three phases to the vow. You'll notice in the story of Samson, the vow gets broken progressively. He breaks each edge of that vow until the last straw, being the straw of his hair, is cut. All right? And then his strength goes away. But you also see him getting further and further into the hot water at that point. Okay, now Israel. They have progressively been breaking the commitment and covenant they have with God in regards to following through on taking the land. Achan defiles. Joshua ignores the idea of getting counsel for God before you make a choice. Okay? No really immediate consequences yet, but then we go forward. We look at this text. The complications of the conquest are not really being spelled out for us because they're not taking everything, just the big things at this point. But looking forward, when we get to the end of Joshua, you're going to see a nice structure parallel to maybe Samson and that progressive level of failure where Joshua is faithful. As for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Everybody else pretty much does it. And so Joshua's last statement is a little bit of foreshadowing for the text of Judges in that way. And so it catches and matches Samson and many other of the judges, by the way, and many other of the larger sections of the Old Testament where there's just progressive breakdown of spirituality. If you want one more connection to see that, look at the churches of Asia. Are their lampstands removed in the text of Revelation? Are they warned about their lampstands being removed? Right, so they are on the edge. And their problems aren't simple. They're not little. They're all big problems for the troubled churches of Asia. For most of them, they got some big issues to work out. There's only one that's really more on the positive end of the spectrum, but their outcome isn't positive. They're in great shape, so they're going to suffer. So you kind of see all of that in the sections of the text we've been looking at. That brings us to the closing parts of what we laid out in the beginning of this section, which is a structure for this part of the text, where we have a northern and a southern campaign. You got Canaan and Dixie, Canaan in the north. We've seen some of that. And now we get the closeout of this segment in these last few verses, which are around verses 16 to 23. So let's now read that together if we can. Joshua chapter 11 and 16 through the end of the chapter. We're going to break it up into two sections. Ken, could you read for us verses 16 through 20 of chapter 11? And then Jordan, could you read the rest of the chapter for us? Thank you. So years ago, back when audio cassettes were a thing. I was handled an audio cassette by my speech teacher in college, and he says, "You need to listen to this sermon." I'm like, "Okay, what, you know, thank you, and do what I'm told." And it was a bit of a spoof outline sermon. And the outline of the sermon was Paul did some good things, Paul did some bad things, and Paul did some things. And the content kind of matched all what you would think about. It was highly condensed. They took all of what Paul did and synthesized it down to three simple statements. Is that true, that Paul did some good things, Paul did some bad things, and Paul did some things? Does that tell us anything, though? There's no substance to it because it's so condensed, we don't have any details. We don't have any experience or information to define the quality or the quantity or the value of any of those. Sections of the Old Testament in some ways are the same thing, where you have a minimalization of time, a shrinkage of this is a lot, and it comes across in two sentences or a verse. And it doesn't get provided to us the level of clarity or depth that maybe an entire day gets broken down, a chapter before, a chapter ahead. Here in this section of the conquest story, that's what you have happen here. A lot takes place over a small amount of sections. But for our purposes, I want us to kind of back up for a second and at least pay attention in this long time frame to three key ideas in the text. Three, I think, valuable perspectives that at least can give us some insight into what is a lot. A lot of the cities are mentioned. There's a little bit of a summary that's mentioned here. There's some additional details that are hinted at. It reminds us of the treaty that is made, but we took some time to break out and consider. But in that, think of it this way, just kind of breaking it down. Yahweh's call, His imperative, His instruction, His desire and His demands are one of the things that's highlighted. Even as Ken was reading toward the close of that section, the statement of Moses is brought into play. Like that Moses left us marching orders, in essence, for part of this. Secondly, that the Lord is involved in the process of our development. And a parallel exists across the board in everybody's lives. And you think about it this way. And I've used this illustration before. The same hammer that creates the Pharaoh creates Moses. Through the same events. The same anvil, which is God, is on the other edge of the compression force that changes them. Pharaoh is hardened by the power of Jehovah. Moses is softened by the power of Jehovah, but he's softened with purpose. The people in Egypt go through the same level of split outcomes, same message, two separate results. Egypt rebels in one way, some of the other nations that are around Israel go a different direction, some escape with the people of God in the Exodus. And so you have that same thing taking them there. So it is here, and we'll kind of break down that text in a second for more details, and understanding the balance of things. All of us have a certain level of anxiety and fear. Even the ones who seem to be the most dynamically bold, they're probably afraid of something, right? We just haven't found it or they haven't told you. But there's a balance because we're told in the New Testament and we're told in the story of God that perfect love does what? Cast out fear. And yet, on another level, we're told to fear God. And fear has purpose. And there are some things that contextually you really need to be afraid of. For lots of very powerful reasons. Fear has a context. Some fears are different than other fears. Some are justifiable fears. Some are group-wise irrational, but individually very rational. If I were to take a groundhog, a rat, a small dog, and let them loose in the ground right now, would everyone respond differently? And I throw a possum in there. Possums are creepy critters. They never look good. How many people are going to be up on the pews waiting for me to solve the problem? A small percentage. Some of us will be like, it's game on. I'm going to get those. Because the same thing can produce different responses because of what we're contextually comfortable with. We're comfortable with being afraid. We're comfortable with being, it's a critter. It's okay. As long as it doesn't bite me, my day's going to be okay. If it bites me, I'll be okay too. I'll just be annoyed. Entire experience. Until it becomes the thing that we fear. Well, in many ways, our fears, though, are actually advantageous. They are part of our design structure. And so let's break this down a little bit and begin to kind of identify some of the things. And so when Yahweh called out Israel to accomplish this, we sometimes start with that paper cutout level of things. He called Israel, in a broad sense, through a series of promises. The promises in the garden and the promises to Abraham, and the patriarchs. But patriarchal promises, what are those commitments? What things are we talking about? Land? Great nation? Anything else? Now, there's going to be a blessing, right? Paper level? Well, that sounds all awesome. And that sounds great. Promises. And they're coming true. When we read about how the process unfolds for the promises coming true, are any of those things super awesome? They end up being super awesome, but they're super uncomfortable. And some of the things that he asked them to do are super weird when you remember that at some points on the development of these people, worshiping Jehovah in this way is new. And if we say that it's weird because it's unfamiliar, because weird, that's all it is. It's just, I've never seen that before. Some of it, like we're talking about, the cleansing commands are weird to us because we're not called to cleanse in that way. By the way, we're called to cleanse on the spiritual level in the same way. To cut out with the same level of ferocity, sin, and unholiness in our lives. That same picture is found in the New Testament. We may not do it all the time, but we're called in the same way. So on a demand level, we don't see that when we see the paper cutout side of the promises. But when we turn the paper cutout and turn it into a three-dimensional picture, and we see all the warts and bits and pieces of the process, and that the people who engage in it are changed as they keep the command, okay, now the severity, the depth, and demand of Jehovah's call to Israel, Yahweh's call to Israel, it's deeper. But that also should change our perception of the people who are called, like Joshua, but also Achan, because those are two types that we see in the text here. Joshua, bold and courageous, gets reminded how often to be bold and courageous? All the time. God tells him to be bold and courageous, and then we learn that he's bold and courageous. That's a clue-giving model. That's how people work. But Achan, do you sympathize with Achan at all? Do you understand him a little bit if you think about it in the three-dimensional big demand picture? Not that it was right. Certainly not right. Consequences were deep and wide to the family of God and to his family. But understanding temptation should give us a sense of sympathy because we're tempted in all the same ways. In exactly the same ways on a daily basis. And we respond in the same ways that the people of God always respond, either draw to God or give in to sin. Because when it gives birth, then it conceptualizes to practicality, and then our sin severs us from Jehovah, just like James teaches. But that's part of that big demand structure that you see there that's kind of included in the teaching side of this summary when this text is kind of bringing a conclusion. In this sense of the text here and the way that God works, you see the interaction. This is verses 19 and 20, the next section of the text. In this section, we're told that only the Gibeonites escaped the big generalities of this work right now. And things that help us see the picture are told to us in the text. Before we enter into Joshua, we're talking Deuteronomy, we're seeing the reputation of Israel grow. They're getting a reputation now as no longer being the wanderers in the desert, but a mighty military force. And their captain, who's their general at this point? God is. He's their general in principle and in practicality until Saul comes on the table. He leads them into army, into conflict with his host of angels. So God is demonstrating through Israel, they're powerful, they're great, they're wonderful, they're awesome, they're amazing. The nations around them are falling before them. And then we meet Rahab. What does Rahab's testimony tell us about how the nations see Israel? They don't know all the details, but yeah, God's doing something. They're really powerful. The nations melt. All the kings are melting. Jericho and Ai fall, big citadels in the region. And then even though there's failure, the strongest southern kingdom comes to Israel, deceives them, so they can be made slaves. We don't even want to fight them. And we're the strongest. And so there's a rise in the power of Jehovah as displayed all through this that is hardening all of the steps of the environment around it. They're taking it from soft edges to hard edges. When you start doing something that's uncomfortable or difficult, and we'll use this illustration, I think it'll work for all of us for the most part. The first time you change a diaper, it's like, okay, operation, gloves, let's sanitize the space. Everything is super cushy for the child. It's like you've got this thing where it's got to be like marshmallows. By about a year in, it's like a 3-second process. And you can almost do that in the air if need be, and no touch. It's like, shoo! At least that's my perspective, too. That's my goal. Other people have different experiences. But in part, it's because you become hardened to the oddness and the smells. Like, it's a diaper. We've got 11 to go through today. It's not a big deal. You become hardened to it. It doesn't bother you in the same way. And you set new goals. And if you're a dad, the goal is to get the diaper changed as fast as possible. Like that's literally a dad level goal. Israel is being hardened in something much more serious at this point. The first time they have to go in and follow a command to clean out the area, that's going to be new for them. Now they're doing it city after city after city. Does that change an Israelite soldier where you go in and you cleanse a community of all of its inhabitants? Well, absolutely it does. The Bible even shows us a contrast in the Old Testament when we think about David and Solomon. Is David a man whom God had great compassion and love for? But one of the things that David wanted to do was not suitable for his experiences, which was what? Build the temple. There's a lot of stuff that goes into the complicated storytelling part of building the temple. There's a lot of other things that we'll get to when we talk about the united and divided kingdom again. But that's a truth. War changes a person. Well, war changed a nation. It always does. It changes those things. And so that changes here. For Israel, there's a big change here. You see that now. You can think about that when you try to figure out what goes next in the lives of Israel as we go into Judges too, because they're a different people than came in. They're going to be changed by their experiences. They're hardened in part in some ways. But so is everyone else around them. Israel comes marching into your town. You know what their history is. Is negotiation going to work? Is running going to work? Maybe. Like you would hope that they would have ran a long time ago. They're not there, they're not there. If they start figuring out some of those bits and pieces. But even more, the whole area begins to firm up as becoming, this is Israel's space. And again, it's that fulfillment of command level that's taking place. And the text is showing us insight into how that plays out. That runs into the last section of the text. There is balance there in the things that we're afraid of and the things that we should be afraid of, the things we think are genuine fears and the things that don't actually have real impact. Because we get afraid of stuff that doesn't make sense. And we talk about irrationality of fears. And they're built off of confusion and misunderstanding. There's a spider that exists known as the wolf spider. And they're present in nearly every single person's living spaces. Wolf spiders are creepy. Why are wolf spiders creepy? Well, their name. What do they look like? What does a wolf spider kind of look like? Big and hairy, and it looks like he's got these fangs that's going to chew me up. I don't care how small or large an adult you are. You are so far above the playing field of a wolf spider that it can't do anything to you. It's possible, I suspect, if you're allergic to their environment or the things they do with their insects, that maybe you'll have a negative reaction to them, just like you would a bee sting. But generally speaking, a wolf spider is really slow. They're really furry. And they eat the insects you don't like even more. But what do we do when we see the wolf spider? Two one of two things. A dead wolf spider or burn the house because it's got spiders. Because they creep us out. And they might even physically respond to them because sometimes they drop on you. They don't normally do that, but they do. And they don't bother me too much, but know what I do when a spider drops on me? You know, it's like, wait a minute. But is it a real, genuine fear? Am I going to be harmed by the wolf spider? No, the wolf spider is going to be harmed by me. My fear doesn't have a real place in reality. Okay, so now we're thinking about God and Israel, God and us. Are we afraid of God at times? Absolutely. If you look at the introduction of the prophets to Jehovah, they tremble at the mightiness of God. When we begin to kind of conceptualize the scope, personality, and place of God, God becomes so significant that we're like, where's my space? I feel like I don't even have room. You can feel choked out. We start putting all these ideas in. And yet God's desire is to embrace us and enfold us and bring us in. So why is there a conflict? What's causing us to be uncomfortable in the hug of God, if you will? It's a new thing. It's a new term. You can use that now. It's not copyrighted. The hug of God. Our own insufficiencies. Maybe some scale issues. If you get hugged by someone so much bigger than you and their muscles are so much stronger than you, you're afraid you're going to get crushed. Think back to the garden. How did Adam and Eve feel when their sin was exposed? Yeah, they're like, we were ashamed, afraid, and naked, so we hid ourselves. The picture there really has to be understood as more than just lacking clothes. That's only one part of the issue. It's the one we latch onto and say, oh, if they put clothes on, everything's better. Nothing was better with clothes on. They had to go out. Everything was still awful. They could not be in the presence of God, even with clothes on because of their sin. And so that's part of the uncomfortableness that comes from fears that have a basis in reality, but we don't always picture the big things. And yet, in the same level, and we're seeing this with Israel at times, we're seeing this in the story side of things, God says, I'm going to keep you safe in the cleft of the rock. God says, I am your shepherd. God says, I will protect you and provide for you. God sends His Son who dies for us. So the same God who we kind of are uncomfortable with, who we're worried about the power of His hug encompassing us so significantly that we can't breathe, says, come in. It's going to be okay. It's not going to suffocate us. And it's not going to kill us. And so you see some of that here, especially inside Israel itself, when there starts to be some of the struggles in regards to how all of this plays out and how Israel begins to move forward in that way. Okay, so any questions about any of that? That's a lot of theological talk over a small textual tidbit. Or things that you noticed in the text, things that are important to you in chapters 10 and 11, spiritually or in the history of God's people. All right then, chapter 12 can be a place we can introduce for a little bit. We've got about 5-6 minutes in the text itself, or in the time of the class right now. There's a lot that goes on here in the text as it goes forward in a shift in what goes on. We're going to have a little bit of history brought in. There's going to be a pause and a reflection in the duality of Joshua and Moses to a certain degree. That's in part why chapter 11 closes off with a bit of a summary. You could also think of chapter 11 as the invitation in parts, if you want to think about it in a sermon form, just like we did with Deuteronomy and Moses' three sermons, if you will, there's a bit of that. But what happens in chapter 12? You guys been reading ahead a little bit? What are some chapter 12 key points that we see here in the text? Right, there's two lists. Right, so you've got two big lists. Les is pointing out you've got Moses pre-crossing time, Joshua post-crossing time, the space of the properties, lands, and layouts of the areas. Some things to remember about lists in the Old Testament and lists in the Bible as a general rule. When you and I make lists, we have a purpose in mind. How many make packing lists for trips? I know Alan does. He better raise his hand really high. we all do, right? Yeah. We all make lists. Our lists are very specific based on our experiences and things that are important to us. Very often, there are things we take for granted that don't go on the list. How many of you put your watches on your travel list? If you wear a watch, you probably don't. Because you just kind of assume that the watch is there, right? So it doesn't go on the list for very practical and specific reasons. A lot of things are like that in our more mundane listing styles. When you decide that you're not talking about packing lists, and now you're talking about an overview of where you've been and did things, things don't always make the list. Let's say you're on that same vacation, that journey you packed for, and you're going to tell it to your grandma and say, we went on a trip. What goes on the list when you tell the story? It literally depends on the age of the storyteller. Little kids, the story starts when they get in the car, it goes to the end of the trip, it comes back to the middle of the trip, it goes to like 2 weeks afterwards, and then it comes back to part of the trip again, right? That's a little kid storytelling style. It's kind of everywhere to the highlights of the last couple weeks. And then they start talking about a month ago. Adults do that too. If you plan it ahead of time, you get the highlights. Maybe you go day by day. On day one, we were in, and day two, we were in. Old Testament story lists. They are either culturally designed or theologically designed. Cultural design is the storytelling styles of the ancient Near East, the way in which people talked and interacted with one another. Theological designs connect to the history of the spirituality of Israel. Are there numbers that are significant in the Bible to the theology of Israel? There are some, yeah. 6, 7, 12, all right? So a lot of the Israelite lists will have 6s, 7s, 12s, 3s, 1s, purposed in the way the lists are put out. New Testament examples, look at the genealogies. They follow a sequential ancient Near East style combined with the theology of Israel, where the 12s and the 7s become important, but they're still ancient Near East in style. Here in the retelling, you're seeing some of that too. By the way, it's not that only. You see it in Numbers, with the families of Israel being laid out. You see it in Kings, with the kings' structures being laid out. And so you're seeing it here too, where God is telling them, or telling us, through the inspired record and telling the receivers of this message the first time, of the spiritual completeness and incompleteness of these tasks. But here, yeah, they're doing it. We're beginning to see the stages of incompleteness show up. And we're going to break some of this down Wednesday because the clock is telling us we have to do that right now. But when you see a list in the Old Testament, pause for a moment, count up the number of things listed, and think about the implications. Almost always you're going to find either theological aspects or ancient Near East storytelling aspects to them. That's it for right now. We get to stop, and we'll be picking up in Joshua 12 on Wednesday night, I think.